Blog Talk Radio.
Yours alone.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Fire Talk Stage Left. I am your facilitator, David Little Eagle, with my co-host and producer, Nell Cole. On tonight's Stage Left, we have an extraordinary, extraordinary guest. Her name is Mary Beth Egling. She is an author. She is also a teacher, I believe. You teach writing. Is that so, Mary Beth? You teach,
right.
You give classes on that?
An
introduction to writing. Well, you are a multifaceted and a very talented and extraordinary human being, Mary Beth. With that, I am going to turn the stage over to you and Nell, in case Nell wants to open up with some questions, because I know that some exciting things happened as of late for you, Mary Beth. And I want to throw a congratulations out to you, and we're going to be bringing that up during the show.
Thank you very much for the nice introduction.
Welcome, Mary Beth.
Thank you.
I'm definitely excited to have you here, and your books are amazing, and I want everyone to definitely read them, because it has so much powerful energy and humanity in it that's so lacking in this world. So I think everybody can come away a different person after reading both of your books. And I thank you for taking the time to put that kind of energy out into the world.
Oh, Nell and David, I'm so honored and humbled that you have said the things you've said, and I truly don't know what to say to such a wonderful introduction. Thank you both for having me.
You just keep doing what you do, and that's words enough. Can you tell me about the opening song and why you wanted Everybody Hurts to be played?
Certainly. Prior to writing my first book, Messages from My Hands, that song pretty much typifies the way that I felt with my entire life. I was very despondent. I didn't know which way to turn. I really felt like everything in my life was lost and worthless. And for some reason, that song, every time I heard it, I felt like I needed to just hang on. And in as much as a song being something that you hold on to, every time I played it to myself in my very weak, weepy moments, I found the strength to just go to sleep and wake up the next day and see what came. And I'm so glad I did, because had I not had the courage to continue on, I don't think I ever would have written this book. So it was a very important song to me in my earlier days when I was really kind of lost and adrift.
Mm.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely always beautiful.
Go ahead, Dave.
No, it's okay. I was just saying it's a very beautiful song, very nice choice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always amazing to me how such beautiful spirits struggled at the beginning to figure out just the many gifts that they've always that was always there. Like, you had so many things looking back that were definite gifts, but at the time you didn't have any knowledge that they would lead you to so much happiness on the other side of things.
You know, I didn't think that, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. There's a lot of people out there right now that perhaps are where I was, and they have gifts. They have something to offer. They have something that
right.
is going to be wonderful if they can just somehow get to the other side of the despair. So it's definitely worth the challenge and the fight.
Oh, definitely. And look, once your spirit opened up, there's no stopping you whatsoever. Because I haven't known you for long, but you're one of the most compassionate people I've ever come across. And it's just amazing to even know you and know that you're out in the world putting that kind of energy out there, and I'm just thrilled to know that you travel through the world and bring this kind of happiness to everyone.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, an open heart is an open heart, and, again, I'm not alone in where I am, and I think anybody who might be listening, especially the two hosts here, know what an open heart is. You have a tendency to just want to make things better and give from yourself, and you almost become addicted to doing that.
Yes. It is a great feeling when you help someone. And you're so generous in the way you do it. So I can understand why everyone around you must be just blessed, because you definitely give way beyond most people.
Well, thank you. There might be some people that would disagree with that, but for the most part, maybe right.
Well, we'll find out their energy and determine why then, because I know.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, but would you like to transition into the reading now, or is there anything you wanted to say first to set up your book, Messages from My Hands?
You know, I think I'd like to start with Chapter 1, Marion, and I think after that point, the chapter actually does speak for itself, so I think I'd rather have that do the talking at this point.
Before you go to that, though, would you mind kind of explaining the book and why you wrote it so that people
sure.
can kind of put it in context?
You know, it's a nonfiction book, and it chronicles the early days of my massage therapy practice, and there are 15 patients that I wrote chapters about. It's really not so much about the patients, but it's about the message that I received from them. That's where the title of the book came, Messages from My Hands. And collectively, the work addresses my redemption. That's really the best and the simplest way to put it. The person that I was prior to writing this book and starting my massage therapy practice is sadly not the person I am now. And this was a real turning point in my life in many ways. And I think I was collectively parented by the people that I wrote about in this book.
Wow. Well, we definitely look forward to hearing it. And David, do you have anything to say before she gets started?
Well, I'm excited. I'm really excited to hear what your book has to tell us, dear. And I anxiously await, and I'm sure that our listeners as well. So once again, it's with great pleasure and great honor that I introduce to you Mary Beth Eglin. The stage is yours.
Thank you. Chapter 1 of Messages from My Hands is entitled Marion. Marion's skin is black, not dark, not brown, not even ebony could describe it. Black like pitch, black like a starless night in the woods, black like India ink black. My skin is white, not fair, not light. Describing it as pale is completely inadequate. White like a marshmallow, white like Elmer's school glue, white like geisha makeup white. Our two skins together made quite a contrast. This observation may seem overly obvious, but it was through this dissimilarity that for me clarity came. I met Marion long before I got my license to practice massage therapy. We met in the dental chair, so to speak. I was working as a dental hygienist in a pro-female office while pursuing my education. I liked her instantly, and the relationship was immediately comfortable. Every 3 to 4 months, she would come to the office to get her teeth cleaned. Over time, talk turned, as it usually does, to more personal aspects of each other's lives. The mere mention of my current educational endeavor caused her to jump in the chair. She had always wanted a massage, but couldn't afford one, being a lower-rung social service employee in a sinking support office. As she spoke of her desires, I had a private side conversation with myself. Massage instructors at school informed us that we were welcome to practice techniques on persons, but we were forbidden to charge them, as we had no license to practice therapy. I stated that I needed people to practice on and asked her if she'd be willing to be my guinea pig. She shrieked that she would love it, but then, looking cautiously sidewise-like, inquired how much is going to set her back. I told her with a smile that it was free. I couldn't charge until I got my license. She accepted with praise be to God and stated that sometimes when you really need it, your prayers are answered. So it was. Later that day, we spoke on the phone and scheduled an hour for me to practice on her. In typical fashion, I have patients start face down. When I enter the room, their back is covered with linens. In order to begin, I undraped her form. Marion had a great expanse of a back. From the moment I began the massage, all I could see were my small white hands on the vast sable background. Now, I've touched dark skin many times, certainly in my many years as a dental hygienist, playing dolls with my little girlfriend in kindergarten, making out in the woods with Amory at a party toward the end of high school, my more intimate, mature relationship with Mr. Jones a number of years back, abundant meetings and handshakes and hugs with so many people darker complexion than me. The experience has never elicited a particular insight into how I saw myself relative to the rest of the universe. I look at my hands all the time when I work. I'm undeniably familiar with my enlarged knuckles and the bend and degree of turn of each finger, the permanent indent where Michael's ring rests when I'm not working, the scar from the time I sliced my thumb open on a can of beans, the remnant of a stubborn wart I tried so hard to hide while in grade school, the path that each vein takes to return blood to my heart, seeing my hands this time was quite different. The gloss on her skin from the massage gel heightened the contrast of the matte finish of my hands. I became enthralled with their movements and undulation, heavy gross movements, light delicate maneuvers. I became aware in the strangest, detached yet connected way of the texture and temperature gradients as I worked the muscles of her body. Marion didn't speak much, in fact, not at all. The stillness and the hushed music and the flood of sensory input provided an opportunity for unique thoughts and images to flow into me. While I was working on her leg, I imagined a great dark pillar of a pier embedded in the cold sand beneath the churning waters of the North Atlantic, a thick, unmoving support to the boardwalk above. My hands were the water rhythmically pulsing up and around and against and about, pushing and pulling back just to start the endless cycle over and over again, white caps forming and moving across deep, dark waters. My hands became an ancient glacier, comprised of uncountable tiny frozen droplets of water, yet collectively an unstoppable force, slowly grinding along the base of a great, sparse, dark mountain, carving a valley in which future life would take hold. I saw that my hands, like water, have an erosive quality, that through repetition and perseverance girded with calm pressure, they could change over time any surface they worked against. I observed the deftness and the wisdom with which they proceeded, the confidence and intuition they demonstrated, the heat they generated, and the sense they released with their warmth. Their fearless foray into places my mind routinely proved inadequate and unprepared to go. All of this without thinking about it. I had little to do with what was happening. I became aware I was simply a conduit, a vehicle through which the energy of the universe entered and flowed back and forth. It then stunned me to recognize I have always read and navigated the world through my outer covering. Anything I have ever really learned or observed had been through my hands or my skin. It's as if it's the only valid entry route to my head, the only truth the paper could be written on. What I heard or observed didn't mean anything until I felt it. I remember collecting stones and sea glass at the beach as a child. I would hold them in my hands and turn them over and over again in my fingers. I could feel their formation, their history, their soul. Like me, they had been tumbled and battered and tossed about for far too long, but they were more beautiful because of it. They were worth saving. As a girl, I sat on our front stoop conversing with the wind. As it blew across my face and chest, I recognized that my body was a small stop on its great journey around and about the globe, and that in blowing past, it took small pieces of me to somewhere else. Fragments of other places entered and exited my lungs as I breathed out my tiny contribution to this collective force, one of the many that connect us all. I just had to touch everything. I was much about texture and tactility, resistance and glide, degrees of firmness and temperature. My mother would go mad every time I walked by the butcher block and put my hand on whatever just came out of the oven. I didn't just touch it, I had to press on it too. I loved to feel the warmth and the consistency. I handled my food before I ate and reveled in those things permissible to eat without utensils like fried chicken or pizza or cupcakes. To this day, when I make cookies for my patients, I lovingly shape the dough with my fingers before putting moist, cool, uncooked morsels on the cookie sheets. I gingerly handled broken bits of glass when I came across them, tested the spike of barbed wire, deftly passed my index finger through a candle flame, became familiar with the smooth, sticky slipperiness of blood. Do not touch signs were a special invitation for me. I had to disregard the instruction. The information I would derive from contact with forbidden things was worth the slight risk of damage or personal injury. Whenever possible, I would immerse my entire body in the experience. I would bury myself in the sand, sit in the mud, roll in the snow, run out in the rain, lie face up on the asphalt to see what the sun had to offer. Lean my bare back against shoulders against a giant tree and then gaze into canopy. My grandmother would shout, "Come back here, Lady Godiva," when I would escape from my towel after my bath to dive naked under the fluffed down comforter on her bed. If I felt it, I understood it. It was mine forever. Touch also guided my understanding of people. My father said he loved me. Well, actually, he never said it. It was implied. Yet he hit me and knocked me on the head with his thick knuckles. He squeezed the top of my arm as he hissed warnings through unmoving lips. Presented with the inconsistency, my somatic interpretation won over what I was supposed to believe. A firm, unquestioned fact was formed, and I knew that I was not loved like a child should be. As time went on, the sensible world chided my understandings and truths and insisted that these things just could not be so. Because I felt a certainty in my body, I did not believe the rejections and denunciations. To satisfy the overbearing, intrusive world, I pushed the truth underground to a more private sleeping space. All this information came to be deeply embedded in every cell in my body, waiting, unbeknownst to me, to be awakened at another time when circumstances would free them. Marian provided the beautiful backdrop that stimulated my insight, and now, before the altar that was my table, I finally realized exactly what was occurring. All the latent memories resurfaced and were being released. I was at long last in a setting to liberate them. A reintroduction to my flawless compass was unfolding. My understanding of the significance of my unique evaluation instruments was crystallized. My hands had always been and forever would remain my primary assessment tools, my gauges, my guides, my secondary yet more dependable sight. All at once I realized what massage was going to be for me, the vehicle by which the floodgates would open and allow me to again take in and interpret the world in a most truthful and accurate way. My conscious reconnection to the universe had been initiated, and I would again and forever be free from the shackles of the sensible world. The pure beauty of this realization opened me to tears. I began to weep with joy at knowing the universe had not given up on me. I looked back and saw that it had continued to send me subtle, yet salient messages even when I ignored it for years, always calling softly to me, sending me signs, hoping I would begin to hear again. Circumstances and intuition had once again placed me in direct contact with our mother source. Every cell in my body knew it was going to be a remarkable, sanctified journey. At the crescendo of my epiphany, I was easing into the final phases of Marian's massage. A Highland rendition of Amazing Grace beckoned softly from the corner. I came to rest behind her head, slowly and rhythmically working the sides of her thick neck. Staring upside down at her beautiful face, I wondered if she was aware of the significance of what had just happened to me. Could she feel my pulse race, my hands quiver? Did she detect the acceleration of my breathing or hear the pounding of my now wide-open heart as the energy from the cosmos rushed in to fill the stale, vacuous void? Could she ever understand? Could I even convey what was presently stirring in me? All at once, Marian's eyes opened, ever so slowly and softly. They appeared profound and timeless. "What is it, child?" Her voice swaddled me in flannel. I was too humbled to answer such a question, too much in awe to speak. Holding her neck and head in my hands, looking down at her with eyes purged with clarifying tears, I could not form the words to utter even the smallest portion of what I was feeling. The moment was suspended and sacred. "Ah, I see," she cooed knowingly, clearly recognizing what had transpired. All of the wisdom from the universe reached out to me from her deep eyes. "You're home, child. Ain't it nice to come home?"
Oh, I just love that. There's... I need a moment for that one. That is just so beautiful. It's such a beautiful dance to even witness. And I can't imagine what it must have been like to feel it. What do you think, David? Go ahead.
To me, it was like you were painting on a canvas. And I could see each and every image that you were painting on this blank canvas. All the colors and all the smells and all the textures just coming to life. And the power of that interaction. Holy cow, I just got chills.
I know it.
Well, I can't get through reading this, whether it's out loud or to myself, without crying, because it brings the whole thing back to me. Truly, that was one of the most significant events of my life, and it happened exactly when I needed it. And Marian was the only person who could have possibly given me that message.
Wow.
Incredible. That's beautiful. Beautiful.
Sometimes the interaction between two people's energy just can create the most magical place that you could ever imagine. And I'm so happy you had that experience and that it woke you up, woke your hands up. So,
you know, it's so funny. My hands are in front of me, obviously, all the time. And I did forget all of the things that I connected to when I was a child because the sensible world said, no, this is not how it is. And how sad that I listened. But it was always there all the time.
We're always shutting our children down of their gifts. And see, after I read your story, I can't tell you how many times today that I've looked at your hands, because it is actually your hands on the book.
That is right. It's I had a picture taken in my hands, because with the title being Messages from My Hands, I couldn't see putting somebody else's on the cover. So
no,
I
absolutely.
Had a
photograph. And I know some people in society would be like, well, we need this and that. But it's your magic hands that are creating all this energy and everything. So I'm so happy that you trusted your instincts on this and put your hands on there. And actually, even today, when I was kind of having a stressful day and I went to lunch, I looked at your book and I placed my hand on top of yours, because
you
I thought that your healing hands, seeing as they were yours, would give me a calming sense. And they did.
Well,
so
you don't,
thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, sometimes I look at my hands to calm myself down, which is a very strange thing. I can't explain it. It's almost like they really don't belong to me.
What do you think that is about your hands? That do you think you're just your sensory sensors are heightened, or what do you think it is about your hands that give you all these gifts?
You know, I really don't know. When I sit down and I try to objectively kind of sort it out, all I know is that, as I said when I read the chapter, that my hands were always the second contact after I looked at something, both for positive and negative. It was like that's how I affirmed anything that I saw or felt or needed to understand whenever I could do it. And it really is a very dependable site for me, and I think that's one of the reasons why the people that have come to me in my practice, we do well together as therapist and patient, because it's just one of those things. It's a good read, and it's a good response, and that's almost a flawless co-therapeutic approach when you think about it.
Yes, it definitely is.
But as far
well,
as
I am, go ahead.
Go ahead, You had mentioned many moments of despondency.
Yes.
And would you say that in this chapter, were you describing that turnaround? Was this when turnaround occurred, when you realized when you understood your calling? Was it at that moment when you worked on this dear woman?
You know, when I had the last chapter of book actually describes how I first had the intuition to get an education for massage therapy, but this event with Marion pretty much affirmed for me that I was on the right track. I didn't know if I was doing the right thing. I was a single mother. I had two little children. I was working full-time as a dental hygienist, and anybody who I said, well, I've decided to go back to school to become a massage therapist, told me I had lost my mind. In as much as I knew it was the right thing to do, there was very little support, because on the surface, the sensible world said, well, you can't do this. How are you going to manage
it?
Yeah,
the unsensible world.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But the sensible world likes to look at itself as the sensible world and the voice of reason. And I knew I was doing the right thing, but when I started working on Marion, that was an affirmation for me that I am on the right path. I didn't know what was going to happen, but
right,
I knew.
Right.
This was the right thing for me.
You went so deep when you were massaging her. It seemed like every fiber of your being woke up. That
it
must
did.
Have been like, I mean, life-changing to feel every little thing within your body. It's like every sensor was almost on overload and yet flowing. So it had to be incredible. I mean, just you reading it itself. It's amazing. So living it, I can't even imagine.
You know, the most amazing thing to me about that whole hour and a half was Marion's response after not asking me anything. She didn't say a word during the whole hour, but she knew exactly what happened. And I even have said to her afterwards, how did you know I was home? She has no way of even reckoning with where that came from. She says, child, that didn't come from me. So
wow.
I really feel the divine intervention that happened between us, and it really was not about what was happening between us. It came from way beyond, you know, she and I working together in a room.
That was mind-blowing. And you know, your description of the wind, when I read it, mm-hmm. I actually called David and read it to him on his voicemail because it just blew me away. I called my husband in the room and I'm like, you've got to hear this description of the wind because you just brought something that happens to us all the time to life in a whole different dimension. I'll never think about the wind the same after reading that. It was just, I mean, just so, you're so alive in all the little nuances of life that we overlook and think, don't even think about, and you feel every last fiber of them, and it's just amazing to watch you.
Well, the childhood I had was that way, but, you know, as I got older, I got farther and farther away from that mother source, and I think that was a lot of my discontent. I had gotten away from what really mattered to me. Thank goodness I'm back.
Absolutely, and you are back in full force, and we are so happy about it. But it is very hard when you're that deep a human being to be in society as a child because they don't understand your gifts. And so it does take many years to get to the point where you find the place where people understand your gift, which is exactly what you did.
And, you know, I look back on all of the years where I was not only not utilizing my gifts, but I was misusing them. And in as much as that was obviously non-ideal, there was experience that was gained through those times. And I look back on the bad times and the times where I am not proud of the things that I've done, but I also recognize that every event that transpired prior to that, the point where I made the decision to go back to school, had a purpose in my life.
Right. It was moving you to where you needed to be.
Right.
And we all have walked some tricky roads to get to where we are today. And we look and shake our head going like, I don't know, somebody had to be watching out for us because some of the decisions should not have led to the...
That's the moment
that we're in. But it did, and thank goodness.
I can only imagine that I had some type of cloak of protection around me because by all odds, I really should not even be here.
It definitely sounds like you went through some major struggles.
I created them for myself. I created them and then went through them. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, we all do. We're all an active participant in our chaos sometimes.
Self-created.
Yep, but, you know, that's life. David, is there anything you want to say about this chapter before we move on to the next one?
Well, very quickly, I wanted to confirm something that Mary Beth was just talking about. Because I can relate to what you just said, Mary Beth. You know, we are given gifts by the great mystery, and when we connect to them in a good way, they work so beautifully. But sometimes the good kind of slips out of our fingers. It reminds me of the teachings of the Anishinaabe. There is a road with many branches of different roads going to the side, and those are the ways of errors, and those are the ways of tripping and falling, very rocky places. And yet the teaching of the Anishinaabe people is that we can turn around and get back on the road that we need to be on. And this is the image that I'm getting from your story, and I admire and I respect your honesty, and I respect your strength, and I respect your integrity and your honor in your work and acknowledging, you know, we're not perfect. You know, we all make mistakes and we all take the wrong turns, but we can always turn back. And I'm very proud of you, Mary Beth, for doing that.
Oh, thank
Absolutely.
You. Thank you. I'm proud of myself also.
Would you mind kind of setting up the next chapter, or is there anything you want to say about the next chapter before you read it?
Yes. Chapter 14 is titled, One to Whom I Give No Name. And this is a very difficult chapter for me to read. It was a very difficult chapter to write. It's one of the most frightening experiences I've had in my life, and there was really nothing tangible. It wasn't like a horror film. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't the death of a child. But it shook me to my core. And one of the things I've found through people reading this book is they have called me or emailed me and specifically said, that chapter upset me so much because this happened to me. And I realized that in telling my story, the commonality of other people experiencing similar things not only gives people the courage to maybe talk about it, but also to maybe take it a step further and do something about it, and also recognize the next time it potentially would happen, because I almost didn't. I hope I get through without crying, because it's very difficult for me to relive. And it's a really long chapter, so I hope everybody's comfortable.
Oh, yeah,
well,
everybody's comfortable.
It's all right to cry. It's all right to cry, Mary Beth.
That's
because you're experiencing what you're writing. And you know what? If you can experience your reading in its true life form, my dear lady, it is going to touch us. We're going to go with you, and we're going to take that journey with you. So by all means, go ahead.
All right.
Absolutely.
Chapter 14, One to Whom I Give No Name. Evil does not force its way into our lives. Negative energy does not pry open our souls. Malevolence does not reign uncontrollably upon us. The devil does not wedge his foot in the door. We make it easy. We smile. We welcome him. We let him in. I met the one to whom I give no name at a time when my practice was solid. Many of my patients, the ones who I've written about, and most of them I've not, helped define the composition of where I was and what I did. I was solid and rooted in only having those people I wanted in my life. I enjoyed the liberation of practicing massage therapy within relationships that were life-giving, authentic, and mutually reverent. My definition of success, I would often tell people. I was also strong and unyielding. I was at long last in a truly committed relationship. I was done looking. Michael was the last man standing. I had found my partner for life and cast off those constraints that kept me a prisoner of myself. My resolve in keeping this final relationship intact was unrelenting and impenetrable. While at the gym one morning, I happened upon the one to whom I give no name, working on a machine on the opposite side of the circuit from me. About mid-50s, well-groomed, not unattractive, we made eye contact. I nodded. He winced. My back, he said factually. I've really been struggling with it. Being me, being helpful, being a massage therapist, I of course jumped in, but not after a brief, almost imperceptible hesitation. Within split seconds, I subdued the prodrome. At the time, I didn't understand it, so I dismissed it and went on. It would later prove to be something I should have heeded. Through conversation about his injury and my profession, I found him to be quite bright and articulate. I asked if he had tried massage therapy. It couldn't hurt and could only help. After I finished working out, I gave him my card as he had asked. I shook his hand. He seemed genuinely surprised by the firmness of my grip and said so. Polite. Made eye contact. Cordial. To my surprise, he phoned that afternoon for an appointment. He scheduled a half-hour treatment slot. He arrived a week later in a polished luxury car. In spite of the fact that it was a cold mid-January day, he had with him a little yipping dog that was jumping around in the back seat. He was on time, in impeccable casual dress. As he approached the threshold of my office, he told me he liked my toe ring. I could feel my right eye close ever so much and my head tilt a little to the same side. The combination of these gestures usually means, what the hell does that have to do with anything? Health history was completed. The usual instruction about positioning was recited as it was hundreds of times before, with no deviation whatsoever from my rhetoric. He looked around my room. I'm enjoying learning about your space, he commented. It tells me a lot about you. I found myself being somewhat annoyed at this comment. Usually an observation such as that would not even faze me. I would thank the person and move on. But I said nothing. Uneasiness was growing. Deep in the center of my body, my warning sensors were going off. I left the room to let him follow my instructions for getting on the table. I washed my hands and prepared myself for work, allowing enough time for him to disrobe. I knocked on the door and asked if he was ready for me to come in. Yes, came his plain response. My reticence cautioned me. I started to open the door and hesitated, then peered through the crack into my room. I could see he had disrobed, but he was lying directly on top of the sheets, completely undressed. I quietly closed the door again and stated in a short, firm voice, that before I would enter the room, he needed to be under the sheets. Now, this happened once before with a dentist I work with. He'd never had a massage. At first visit, I believe that he was sincerely confused and very nervous. He did not drape himself. I have since then greeted him with a smile as Dr. Butt Naked. We got past it and went on to establish a comfortable routine therapist-patient relationship. But this was different. It took on the likings of a game, of a test, of me. I felt myself becoming battle-ready. He responded immediately. I could hear him get under the sheets. I asked him again if he was indeed under the sheets. Yes, came the response from the other side of the door. I entered to find him positioned properly and under the linens and draped. Don't ever do that again, I commanded curtly. I'm sorry, he offered. I guess in the confusion I misunderstood. I myself thought it a bit strange that I should not be covered. I gauged his response. I told him next time he was unsure of instructions, he should ask for clarification. This guy is so full of crap, I thought to myself. But I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. There have been many patients with whom things started out rocky and ended up glass-like. I initiated the session. As I started on his back, he attempted to make light conversation. He asked me to tell him about myself. I chose an informal topic. I told him about my practice. I chose a critical tidbit topic. I let him know that I had an amazing partner named Michael and that I was content and secure in my relationship. I chose a safe topic. I told him I was working on a book, that it was in the midstream stages, and that it was set in the context of my professional experience as a massage therapist, but that it really addressed my own deliverance. He asked me if I could give him specifics. I told him no. I'm writing a book as well, he said. I was happy to have the conversation shift and felt some strange fellowship with another struggling author. I asked about the content of the work. It's about why men lie, he explained. Really, I said, we have needed a definitive work on this topic for some time now, I said agreeably. Now that is a book I would definitely read. Things were going smoother now, and I was almost completely at ease. Almost. Usually for a half-hour acute need appointment for lumbar pain, I allow 20 minutes for decompression of the related muscles of the back, and then I position the patient on their back and spend the remaining 10 minutes sitting at their head manipulating the neck and shoulders. During a moment of idling conversation while working on his back, I had a strong intuition, hearing that voice say, don't roll him over, keep him face down. I dismissed this at first, but through the course of working, I again heard the message in my head. After a third time, I thought, all right, I get it, in response to the invisible prodding. I literally shrugged my shoulders and nodded to the universe. I would honor the strange command and alter my usual treatment method. I did not understand it, but I thought it best to defer to the wisdom that was larger than me. The usual wrap-up and dismissal went without incident. I waited until the car pulled out of the driveway and turned and re-entered my treatment room. I felt strangely ungrounded as I reviewed the events of the last 40 minutes or so, and then shocked at my agitation to the butt-naked happening. It seemed as if I was trying to convince myself. Typically, I will solve most concerns on my own. I take private time to work through my issues and arrive at a plan of proceeding, and I do not often ask for assistance in matters of interpersonal dynamics. However, these circumstances were quite another manner, and preserving the cohesiveness of my relationship with Michael came to mind. After short consideration, I made the decision to break from my solitary approach. When Michael got home from work, I told him about this patient. I relayed all the events as they occurred and my feelings when they did. The fact that I was talking about it meant that I was concerned. The fact that I was concerned caused him to become so. Are you going to treat him again, he asked, hoping I would say no. Well, I responded, he didn't schedule another appointment, and I'm certainly not going to ask him to. Michael's brow was furrowed. He told me that if I had no objection, he was going to ask around the gym to see what was up with this guy. Michael had been a member for many years and knew just about all the staff and the early morning workout people. I kissed him and told him to get back to me with a reconnaissance report. I saw the one to whom I give no name at the club a few more times. He stated that his back was feeling better, and along with a few adjustments from the chiropractor, he was doing well. Though he did not ask to schedule another appointment, and he did not say he'd call for one, I began to get the sense that he was hovering around me. He would seek out small conversations each time I would run into him. He was flushing me out, assessing my caliber, engaging me to learn about me. Initially, I found myself being almost unfriendly at his presence. I had to work at being cordial. But as time went on, I viewed the conversations as civilized challenges. Soon I began to see the interactions with him as a battle of stealth and strength and wits. Nobody puts me in the place where I do not have the upper hand. I do not back down. I decided that I was going to get in it. I put my war paint on. The circling face-off began. My reticence turned to subterfuge. My avoidance became confrontation. My distancing changed to active engagement. a few have told me that some of my most impressive characteristics come out when I'm pushed. I can judiciously apply witty sarcasm with fearless posturing and caustic humor. I must confess that I love being in this place. I regularly suppress and withhold my battle-driven soul, but when I unsheath this sword, a dormant part of me comes alive. Without warning, he called for an appointment. He asked if he could schedule an hour. I told him 30 minutes would be sufficient. Things will be different this time, I postulated. When he pulled in the driveway, I saw that poor little dog in the back seat again. On many occasions, I had seen tiny pet in the car at the gym, out in the cold, yelping to passersby. That dog is a prisoner, I said aloud to the snow. Why do you keep that dog in the car all the time? I more observed and asked when he approached my office door. She likes being with me wherever I go, he responded. Doesn't much look like she does, I said flatly. For this second visit, I postured myself as the ultra-professional, the ice queen, as my friend Bev refers to this role I sometimes must play in order to maintain direction and control in my massage room. This time I told him after a brief inquiry as to the status of his pain, get under the sheets or else. He put up his hand apologetically. I know, I'll be out of here. I don't make the same mistake twice, he concluded. Satisfied, I left the room and returned to find him and everything else in perfect order. Though the rest of the visit went without notable incident, I was making mental notes and gathering information for myself while I worked. He had a definite strategy of casually trying to find out about me as much as he could, not to make conversation, but to learn, to ascertain. I turned all initiations back to him so my personal life was not the central focus of the conversation. He responded as if he was only playing along. I made the decision based on my intuitions from the last visit not to turn him over. I kept him face down. Things were going well, and I was driving. Suddenly, just as I began to feel myself relax, I felt this incredible rush of energy from my body. Not the one I give freely to my patients, or my children, or my lover, but one that was taken from me like my fortress was forced open, and all my warmth escaped into a cold, lifeless void. I felt the drain of life from my body against my conscious will, like there was a struggle initiated from my personal space. I immediately put up an energy wall in my chest and stopped the vigorous draw of my breath into his body. My hands continued to move in robotic fashion, yet I completely disconnected myself from him. I intently sniffed the air for additional inferences. His pulse, respiration, and breathing did not change at all, but my heart was racing. By this time, the last few minutes couldn't pass fast enough, so I decided to end the massage early. Something wasn't right, and I didn't like it. When I dismissed him, I told him I was done. He said that he could see that, and I said, no, I was really done. I indicated I could not help him, and I would not reappoint him for any more visits. He looked rather surprised, did not ask me what the issue was. I did not offer an explanation. He paid my fee and then went back into his wallet for a tip. As he pulled $5 out of his billfold, I told him with a self-assured smile that I earned my fee, but I did not want anything more from him other than for him to get the hell out of my office. I phoned my fighting partner afterward. I told him what happened. Michael listened patiently for me to finish, and then it was his turn. He told me that just that morning he had managed to get this info on the guy. He was relatively new at the gym, and he was causing some trouble, and some of the female members had complained that he was hitting on one of the young personal trainers he hired and was making her increasingly uncomfortable. She decided to drop him as a client after he told her she reminded him of Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, that he was dating one of the receptionists in the check-in area. Michael told me her name, and I knew whom it was, a petite, submissively postured woman. I asked her if she knew anything about him, Michael continued, and she denied even knowing him, he said emphatically. This guy is a predator, Mare, he added, as if it was not already understood. I suddenly remembered the yipping dog that traveled enslaved, and I was immediately afraid for the front desk woman. When Michael came home that day, he hugged me hard. I told my love that I went from being concerned to being angry that a person like that stalks the earth. I told Michael that though I dismissed him from my practice, I wasn't done yet. I'm going to take him down, I whispered into his ear. Michael pulled away and grew visibly upset. He told me that he preferred that I not mess around and that this was not a game and it might be best if I just left the whole thing alone. This guy is a menace, I charged. He's preying on women. I was going to do everything in my power to stop it. I will not be guilty of an action, I finished defiantly. Michael sighed despondently. He said that my pride and my stubbornness were getting in the way of my usually clear vision. I told him I would be fine. Unwisely, I ignored his plea. On the way into the gym the next morning, I scanned the parking lot for my nemesis and his captive pet. No sign of him. After my swim, I decided to go get a bagel before I went on my way. I walked into the deli, and there was the one to whom I give no name, sitting in a sunny spot at a window reading the paper. We made eye contact. I nodded. As I walked past him, without looking up from his paper, he suggested I join him after I got my order. I'll show him, I said to myself as I waited for my bagel. I will not run. I will not hide. I will face him. I thanked the young man at the counter and stepped toward the table. Every bone in my body told me to keep walking. But no. I sat down. We've gotten off to a bad start, he began. I said nothing. I'm going to come clean, he said, like that's possible, I thought. I chewed my bagel and still said nothing. I find you very attractive. You're very smart, extremely witty. Your confidence is inspiring. He went on to tell me that in his wallet he carried a slip of paper. On it were four adjectives to describe what he needed for a perfect partner in a perfect relationship. I asked what they were. He told me. He added that when he met the woman who fulfilled this description, he would know that he met the person meant for him. You fit my requirements, he said to me. I sat back in my chair in astonishment. What a pompous ass, I said way under my breath. I reminded him that I was very happy and content with my relationship. I asked him what he thought his girlfriend at the gym would think about his finally finding the perfect woman. He was taken aback by this supposedly hushed fact. I told him that I had no interest in him and no desire to speak to him anymore. As I got up from the table, I remarked coyly, I noticed that love is not on your pathetic list. I left my garbage for him to clean up. A couple of days later, I received a small card in the mail. On the front was a poem from David White, Where Many Rivers Meet. One of the passages from poem read, In this high place, it is as simple as this, leave everything you know behind. Holy shit, I said to myself. My hands were shaking as I opened the card. The handwritten inscription read, Mary Beth, thank you for our conversation this morning. I was moved and inspired to find myself embraced in the joy of what we are creating. If we stopped today, I would know that I was known finally and that it would fill a very important hole in my life. Someday I hope to give all this heartfelt, more like pounding love, passion, and commitment that I have welled up while I have been waiting for her to knock at my door. I hope you come in. Well, this about completely freaked me out. I was angry. I was concerned. This guy just didn't listen. I was a little scared. What had I done? I sat on the couch. The realization hit me that I made all this possible. This guy had played to my weakness, which I saw as strength, to continue to engage me, and he almost succeeded, and I didn't even want to think about what. But I was blinded by pride and bravado. By this point in my development, I'd certainly learned a lot, many things, clearly not everything. I finally comprehended that I might actually be in a dangerous place. Since the situation had already caused some low-grade conflict between Michael and me, I wondered whether to call. I hate I told you so reckonings. Yet it occurred to me that by not calling, I'd be allowing the one to whom I give no name to put a chasm in our cohesive, honest relationship. It was time to suck it up, and I dialed the phone. I want him out of our lives now, was Michael's not-so-calm response. Understand that Michael never tells me to do anything. He may ask of me. He may request consideration of me. He may suggest. He's astute, and his understanding of how to deal with me is complete. He knows that the surest way to compel me not to do something is to tell me I have to do it. So given the situation, I felt his response was an appropriate call for an overdue definitive action. Michael decided to get involved, and I did not discourage. Michael usually is gone from the gym before I get there, so he spread the word around before I arrived. He informed one of the very large trainers that I was having real trouble with a member and asked if he'd watch out for me. News spread fast that morning. Apparently, the one to whom I give no name alienated quite a few people, men and women alike. By the time I arrived, the air was thick with anticipation. Many nodded knowingly to me as I walked through the wait area. A few of Michael's friends positioned themselves on equipment in close proximity to where I was working on the low back machine. The gigantic trainer leaned against the wall, with bulging arms folded across his massive chest, watching. As if on unaware cue, the one to whom I give no name entered the gym and unknowingly began to walk the gauntlet. He pleasantly greeted a few members but got no replies, no smiles, just frigid looks. I watched him become increasingly uncomfortable as he wandered into the unresponsive cold air of combined distrust. He quickly surmised that something was amiss and figured out he was the focus of the unwelcoming reception. He self-consciously walked toward me, quickening his pace, desperately hoping that there was at least one friendly face in the hostile environment. He stopped directly in front of the machine I was working on. I came at that moment to upright position on the apparatus, eye level with him. Right before my now instantly opened eyes, I witnessed the most hideous thing I have ever seen. His face somehow subtly morphed into an ugly, dark caricature, like when two left sides of a person's face are put together to form one expression. His skin turned ashen, and gray shadows formed above his cheekbones. I froze, and my eyes widened as they fixed on his mouth. His lips were forming words, but I heard nothing. I was deafened by the shock of seeing an inky mist vaporizing out of his orifice as he formed his silent words. I backed away to see a repulsive black aura come about his head. The universe had let me see that I was in the company of one of the blackest hearts walking this part of the earth. His exact plan to get it was hidden, but he wanted my soul. Mm. I locked my eyes on his as I slowly got off the equipment. "I know what you are," I hissed. As I slowly walked away, I caught a glimpse of the big trainer and my other sentinel moving toward him. I never found out what had transpired after that, and I didn't care. When I got out of the workout area, my pace quickened to the front desk. There was the petite victim of the demon. I told her I needed to speak to the director immediately. She asked what it was concerning. Who knows what he's told her about me, I thought to myself. I told her it was none of her business and to just get him. I spent a few moments informing the owner of what was skulking and prowling around his facility. I told him and his staff members should not have to deal with this behavior, and I thought it was prudent to exile the demon. If he did not take an indicated measure, I would take further action. I got in the shower, my chest heaving as the cool water ran over me. I wanted to wash him away forever. I needed to be home fast, and there was one more thing I needed to do. 12 miles later, I made my last contact with him. I called his number, and he answered the phone. Apparently, his gym visit had been cut short. "Hi," he sang, obviously pleased to hear my voice. He still didn't get it. I told him never to approach me or call me or talk to me again. If he did, the police would be contacted. "Just like that?" he asked. "I don't even get a reason?" "No," I stated definitively and hung up the phone. On Monday morning, I showed up to exercise. In the weight area, the same group of people were there as the day of the confrontation, but the mood was light, almost celebratory. Michael's friends gave me high fives as I walked by. The big trainer formed guns with his thick fingers and beamed. When I walked into the locker room, the pretty personal trainer stopped me and grabbed my arm. "Thank you," she smiled. "He's gone." As I was leaving, I passed the front desk. I stopped and turned to inquire as to the whereabouts of the girlfriend of the demon. The receptionist informed me that she had quit suddenly last Friday. I heard his voice in my head saying again, "She likes being with me wherever I go." This chain of events that occurred at my hand made quite an impression on me on a number of levels. Primarily, my body knows I'm in danger, long before I do. I was so very foolish to ignore it. I would never disregard it again. Secondly, I learned to continue to keep what I treasure close. When facing the consequences of my recklessness, I discarded isolation and deferred to the power of inclusion and the subsequent strength of two. Telling my partner of my self-created problem only assisted in the solution, but also strengthened my resolve to keep my relationship solid. Most importantly, I finally learned the importance of disengaging my ego, not only when it is evident that it will harm, but also when the consequences may not be so obvious. My unhealthy sense of self was the last anchor to fall from me. The liberation I've experienced due to this exfoliation is like no other freedom I've earned. As we lay in flannel that night, I told Michael I was pleased that the one to whom I give no name was out of our lives. Yet I couldn't help but think about his captives and the disquieting fact that he would most likely hunt again somewhere else. Michael was equally as moved as I. A short time later, he wrote a poem to chronicle the battle and honor the outcome. I'd like to share it with you. Of all he has written, it is by far my favorite. The Predator. Scrutiny from a distance to consider my approach. An unsuspecting quarry, a probable new host. This latest prey is special, distinctive posture, self-assured. A different slant must be taken, her instincts must be blurred. An appeal to the intellect, a challenge to the mind, weighty banter will provoke and stimulate this kind. I'll test this young soul's mettle, my scheme will now unfold, wanton failure I shall tender, false victory for her to hold. Blinded by the victory, consumed with her false pride, she'll fail to see the demon my black soul hides inside. I weary of her conviction to the beloved she holds so dear. I display an understanding, but selfishly don't care. I'll continue with my swank, disregard her taught insistence. Like many women reaped before, I'll conquer her resistance. I simply can't believe, how can she be so brash, snubbing my next ploy to disrupt my planned advance? An invitation I'll no offer, to knock upon my door. I will eat this vixen's heart. This has always worked before. Expectation now rings true. I knew that she would call. Satisfaction is mine. Her soul will take the fall. The voice I know is hers, but the retort, it is all wrong. I persist for explanation. The line's gone dead. She's gone. How can I be discharged? These reasons are not clear. I had her in my grasp. This woman has no fear. I did not respect her second. Her sword cuts deep at me. The strength of two now present. I'm cut off below the knee. The specter of her partner, unseen but felt so near. Soon our paths will also cross. He too will have no fear. Until another is offered, I'll heal the pride that stings. I will feed upon another. She's waiting in the wings. I care not if love exists. I must possess the soul. I scoff the one who preaches, the enlightened one in gold. So I hunt the traits again, the four that feed my pride. Love is not on the list, but that is why men lie.
Oh. Wow. That whole thing is just so amazing on so many levels. But I'm going to let David start first. David?
I'm here. I was just flipping my own pages. That was really powerful. Wow. The illustrious stalker. And, you know, unfortunately, they do appear in both genders, and it is a really fearsome thing. And I, you know, doesn't matter who the victim is. And I don't like using the word victim, because victim implies someone who has taken it and not fought back, in a sense. I view you more as a warrior that took a stand and made the enemy run. Because, you know, this is a really... I hope to all the listeners out there who are listening to the show tonight are taking notes. I know I am. Very, very powerful stuff, Mary Beth. And hats off to you, lady. Hats off.
Absolutely. Because I got the book yesterday, and I was reading that last night, and I was just blown away by it. So I called her and said that she had to read it tonight, because, you know, in our network, we fight these kind of people all the time. And it's very important for people to understand the dance that they're doing and how they pull you in. So I wanted this piece as part of the collective truth to let men or women both know that once you're lured in, that you've got to start fighting back, and you've got to see who's really in front of you. Because,
right on.
Mary Beth, you see who's in front of you, but the world doesn't. So it's very easy for the world to pull you back in. Like, I love the way you said that we welcome them with a smile, and that's so true, that society makes us question our instincts and say, no, that would be rude. No, we need to give that person a second chance, or we need to dull down our senses because, you know, we can't be right. This can't be true. When in reality, it is very much true. And I'm always happy when a woman or a man begins to embrace that inner voice that says, you're in danger. Watch out. You know, go ahead.
There are dark souls that walk the earth. And
absolutely.
There are people who would like to just reserve that for horror pictures and fiction. But if you open your eyes, you meaning anybody, they're around us. They're around you.
They're all over.
That's right. And your body is always the first warning sign. If you pay attention to what your body's telling you, like I did or didn't, I acknowledged it sadly and I just pushed it aside. You always have that compass with you, and no matter how dulled it may be, it still works when it needs to. But we just have to push it aside, because it doesn't make any sense. It's intangible. You know, there's no logic behind it.
Yeah, I have very strong reaction to those types of people. I have no tolerance for it anymore. Used to, I made excuses. Now I'm just like, they have to go. That's it. They make me physically ill even being in the presence. I just can't do it anymore. Oh God, that was so fantastic. What I want to do now is take a break, because I want to make sure we allow plenty of time for you to talk about your other book. So we're going to play a song, Drive. Can you tell us about the song and why you wanted it played?
Well, I think that I finally got to the point in my life where I realized I was driving my own life. Good, bad, and different, I was the only person who was responsible for where I was going. And the sense of being where I was with the first song that I had chosen, coming out of it was a natural progression for me to finally be in control of my life.
Absolutely. Wow, you are such a powerful woman. All right, everyone, I'm going to play Drive.
Nell Cole, and with us on the stage tonight is Mary Beth Eglin. Welcome back, and again, welcome to you, Mary Beth, and thank you for that powerful reading. For everyone who is just tuning in, you missed something really extraordinary, really powerful, but you haven't missed everything, because on the stage again, with great pride and honor, I introduce again Mary Beth Eglin.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do, Mary Beth, is I'd like to transition pretty quick into Loveabouts to make sure we have plenty of time for you to read and us to discuss it. So
sure.
Can you kind of tell us about your book, and then I'll let you take the stage and begin reading.
Absolutely. Loveabouts, it's called Loveabouts, Enriching Your Life and Deepening Your Relationship, and it cannot be any different from the first book I wrote. It basically is how to integrate affirmation into your life, how it will change your life, the lives of your family, and hopefully will change the world. It's a simple concept that I practiced with my children for many years, and one day I just decided to sit down and write a book about how to do it. I kind of integrated the sociology and the psychology behind affirmation and put it out there to hopefully improve people's lives.
And with that framework being set, would you mind reading for us?
Absolutely not. I'll read first chapter, How Loveabouts
okay.
Came to Be. 19 years ago, I birthed a baby girl. I sat in that small bedroom holding Heather in the rocking chair I received as a shower gift from all the women members in my family. Looking down on her beautiful face, I found myself completely awed at the potential of this little person, for there's nothing more exciting than the possibilities ahead of a new baby. I wanted her to be happy and hoped her to be confident and self-assured. It was important that she learn to believe in herself. I leaned my head back on the chair and gently rocked while Heather slept. Thoughts took me back to my own childhood. I closed my eyes and sighed. The things I wished for my new baby were not present for me when I was young. Sure, I had clean clothes and good meals, a great neighborhood and many idle hours of play, went camping and took trips to Myrtle Beach, but I lacked the components necessary to fortify and bolster my young soul. I grew amid circumstances that did little to buttress my internal confidence. Things that I did poorly were given much attention, things that went well very little. As a result, I overcautiously planned my actions and processed inevitable mistakes with concealment and fear. The budding spirit in me was duly oppressed and driven underground. It was an arid environment, at times quite harsh. Interestingly, my bleak formation turned out to be quite advantageous. I do not resent it. I actually am quite grateful. I would not be the person I am now if I were missing the stoic characteristics that the early experiences stirred in me. I raised my head and gazed again upon my baby. I found myself wondering exactly what meaningful thing I could do to help her along the difficult path I knew life to be. I made a decision that, at the end of every day, no matter how great or terrible it may have been, I would make sure that any errant words or whispers were set straight. I would ensure that my little one drifted off to sleep knowing that she was indeed valued and deserving of love, that no matter what the world told her about herself, her mama would speak last and louder than anything else she was subjected to that day. I would deflect negativity and concentrate on and celebrate the positive. It seemed to be there could be no better way to put a baby to sleep. But how to accomplish this? Intuition graced me. I would begin a ritual, starting tonight, a rite of affirmation to swaddle her for sleep. I would hold her close and snuggle her and tell her one thing I loved about her from every just-ending day. I would look into her blue eyes and squeeze her close to me as I sweetly told her why she was so special. True, she could not yet understand the words coming from my mouth, but the vibrations coming from my body would be unmistakable. Her body and her soul would certainly understand what I was saying to her, until such time that her mind would also comprehend the moment. I told my baby Heather what I decided to do and exactly why I decided to do it. I put her to my chest and cradled her little head in my hand, her face very close to my neck. I rocked her and told her that one thing I loved about her was that she was patient and cooperative while I properly pinned her cloth diapers. Thank you, I said to my little baby girl. So started our nightly ritual. That felt so nice. I rocked some more. It seemed to make sense that her telling me one thing she loved about me would naturally follow. I decided, since she was yet unable to reciprocate, I would tell her one thing I loved about myself until such time that she could do so. I told Heather that one thing I loved about myself was that I was going to work hard to give her all I could, so she might become a most confident, self-assured woman. Our private ritual went on without fail or exception. She would always listen and soon began to speak. At three, she was certainly talking all the time, but had not yet, I thought, grasped the concept. But somehow the magic of the moment registered inside her. One day after her bath, we sat together on the rocker, both of us working around my sizable belly that held her soon-to-be-born sister, Shannon. We got situated, and I began our nightly routine. I told her what I loved about her from that day. Much to my surprise, Heather joined in. She said to me, "Mommy, one thing I love about you is that you have a nose." She looked up and beamed. I, of course, started to cry. I hugged her tight while I composed myself and then finished our loving ritual. From that day forward, she was able to tell me one thing she loved about me. Initially, Heather's participation was certainly rudimentary at best, but the key was she did participate. As she got older, her awareness of exactly what we were doing became clearer. Now, instead of being loved for having normally occurring body parts, I was being recognized for reading stories at bedtime. I was being thanked. I was told I had pretty blue eyes. I was being paid compliments. But more important than her developing ability to recognize something nice about someone else was her awareness of those things in herself that were wonderful and worth mentioning. What started as "one thing I love about myself is I know my colors" soon progressed to "one thing I love about myself is that I care about animals." Much to my amazement and joy, it was just as easy for her to think of something nice about herself as it was to recognize niceties in someone else, a powerful ability indeed. Soon afterwards, Shannon came into our world. Heather was very excited about the prospect of the new baby. She wanted to help and be part of all involved activities. On the night Shannon came home, after diapering and feeding our new baby, I moved to put her to sleep. Heather jumped up very definitively and stated in a reprimanding tone, "Mommy, we have to do loveabouts with Shannon too." I never before labeled what we did every evening for the past 3 years. Now it had a name, loveabouts.
And I think that book is the most magical book I've ever read, because depending on what it does and what you put into it, it really can change your entire family, every last inch of your family. And I've seen it actually start to work in my own network with my friends. And I have, and it's really changed a lot in her life. And I did it for my mom and my daughter. And it's because there's so much in life that we're desensitized to now. We're all in the same house, but we're invisible to each other. Mm-hmm. And this little book, with all its power, can bring your family back to life. Now, how much more powerful can you get than that?
That's what I'm hoping for now.
Absolutely. I know exactly what you're hoping for, and you've given everybody the tools to do it. All they have to do is pick it up and begin and go through that uncomfortable stage, and it really can become magic. Everybody wants to know what their kids are thinking, but do you want to take the time to ask? Do you want to take the time to create the energy to hear them? Because this setting can do just that. You can actually hear who your child is. And not just think, you know, they'll actually tell you who they are. And that's a powerful tool.
It's kind of strange because it's almost like we need permission to do something like this. And a couple families have said, well, it's so nice to be able to say now it's time to do loveabouts, because it has its own space and time. And it almost gives them permission, which is terrible to say, to say nice things about each other or to say something nice about themselves. It's a ritual. Which rituals have a tendency to be carried out.
Exactly. Especially with male children. They wouldn't just go by each other and go like, "You know what I love about you, brother," is, you know, they wouldn't do it.
No.
But in this kind of setting, it gives them permission without judgment to actually open their heart. And fathers, sons, you know, mothers and all kind of stuff. Step parents. I love the fact that most step-parents and children kind of stay in their own little space, and this actually makes them have to look at each other and find things they love. It really is just pure magic on every level that you can imagine. What do you think, David?
Well, I'm thinking about my own experience because I have two beautiful, extraordinary daughters, and for many years they were not allowed to think anything nicely of me. And I have been essentially isolated from them and them from me. And yet, you know, my daughters and I are closer than ever before. And one thing that I wanted to mention is, like, my daughter, my youngest daughter, had posted something on Facebook saying, you know, Daddy, I got three things from you. I got your musical ability. I have your passion for justice and a heart of compassion to help others. And when she wrote that, I kid you not. I mean, I'm a man, but I'll tell you, I just broke down and I started crying when my daughter wrote that. And it just, you know, I think that that's what it's all about. You know, it's easy for children not to see the positive in their parents, and it's absolutely almost essential for parents not to see the good in their children. But when, you know, I look at my daughters and my heart just, it just beats so fast with such love and pride for these two extraordinary women who are mothers now in their own right and great moms. My grandchildren are beautiful and growing up strong, and there's such a strong love there, and that's an inherent gift that I see in my daughters, you know, that really touches me. So, you know, I'm listening to what you're reading, Mary Beth, and I'm going, yeah, you know, that is magical. That is powerful in a good way. You know, I had written something earlier that says that true power heals and strengthens and true strength protects and serves. And, you know, without the true essence of humanity, there is no humanity, and without humanity, there is no power and no strength. And I think that when family members can encourage each other and see the beauty and the positive things in parents, in children, in siblings, and, you know, and even in our extended families, you know, like Nell is my extended family, and I see awesome things in her. I think that that's the way to build humanity. So, you know, right?
Absolutely. Oh, wow. I just love the whole energy of it. There's just endless possibilities to it. Now, what is your advice for people who may be a little resistant? And because sometimes mothers bring stuff in, or fathers, and the children roll their eyes and go like, oh, we're going to do what?
Well, I think that persistence, you know, one of the chapters I talk about how to do love abouts, and it's a basic primer of, you know, you sit down, you face each other, there's no distractions. And kids will generally be resistant after about age 8 or 9. Little kids generally seem to be more than happy to do this. But work past the resistance. One of the women who bought my book had called me to tell me that she was so impressed of what her 13-year-old said to her 5-year-old. They're both boys. And she said, I couldn't get over how much of an effect it had on my younger child that his older brother actually thought of something nice to say. And he put up a big fight about it at first, but she stuck to her guns and said, no, you know, we're going to do this at night because it's important, and humor me, basically. Well, the whole family does it every night now, and he is actually has dropped his guard against it and apparently is really enjoying doing this. And it's fun.
It does go into the power of positive thinking, because if you're going through the day trying to figure out what positive to say about your family instead of ripping them to shreds, like so many families now where they just, it seems like you're in a combat zone where it's just like yelling and rushing and all the different things that just smother what a family's supposed to be. All these electronics and all these different things. And it's up to the parents out there to fight for that connection, because when that time's gone, it's gone forever.
Well,
and so
really
now's the time to take control of your family, and something as simple as this book can bring your family back to life and change your entire history, your grandchildren's history. It can become a tradition for years and years to come.
Absolutely.
And it's just right here in your hands. It's up to you.
Somebody once told me, it's not the gifts that children will remember in Christmas's past. It's the little things they remember. That
right.
time that Dad took us out to around the bonfire and we roasted marshmallows and went bobsledding downhill. Those are the things that children remember, because those are the bonding moments where, you know, it's person to person and not based on any material gift, but the gift of the heart.
Right.
Very powerful stuff.
I am not claiming that this is an original idea. My daughter named this ritual we did, but basically it's incorporating compliments and thank you into your daily existence. And
uh-huh.
and there is a shift that happens in your body and in your brain. You can actually rewire your brain to call upon positive things just by thinking of things that were positive. And a lot of people
right.
will look at that and say that's not possible, but it's power of attraction. You can call into your life anything that you choose to call into it. And the human brain can also not think of two things at once. When you're searching for a positive entity, you cannot possibly be thinking a negative thought. And even for that moment, you assuage any pain that you've experienced from a bad day or from something somebody did to you or something that somebody happened to you. And that's why I recommend people do it at the end of the day in their family setting, because everybody has rough days.
Oh, yeah. And I know it's hard with people's schedules and, you know, you're coming home from football or whatever is going on, but it's extremely important to do, and it can be done in, would you say, under 15 minutes?
Usually, well under 15 minutes, especially if you have a small family unit, maybe four or five people, it's very quick. So it's the most important 15 minutes you'll spend during the day with your family, I guarantee it.
Right. And I could see where the end of the day would be definitely a time. It must be, I couldn't even imagine my father sitting around and saying kind things about
that
me and how valuable that would have been.
Well, it didn't happen in my childhood either. And, that's just the way it was. And I didn't want my children to have that type of formation. This idea came to me, as I said, I was graced with an intuition that just kind of continued. And many years ago when I started writing the book, I just thought that this was too cool not to share with everybody.
Right.
I'm extremely happy and proud of the effect that I believe it's had on both my daughters, who are now 21 and 18. And they still call me and tell me what they love about me from college, by the way.
That's really so amazing.
Yeah.
That's so amazing. What else has happened in your life because of this book?
I have had an incredible amount of people just call me and email me and tell me how loveabouts have helped them. One of the challenges that I put in the book is make loveabouts your own. You don't have to follow my rules. You can do what you want to do with it. And I love hearing about all the creative ways that people have been able to integrate compliments and integrate thank you into their life. The other thing that's happened is another affirmation that I just really like doing things that help people. It makes me feel so good. I just, the smile on my face is unremovable for hours after I get a phone call or an email like that. And I have a little scrapbook that I keep with all the people who write me notes and thank yous. And it's just such a wonderful, thick book of an outpouring of love that it should be there all the time.
That's one thing I've noticed about you, is that you have such a deep level of compassion. And is that something you've always had, or was it something that developed from this book? Do you feel like this book and doing these loveabouts has developed your humanity, or do you think it would have been the same?
You know, Nell, I was the oldest of four children. I have three younger brothers that were all within 5 years of each other, and I was the nurturer, the protector. I was the person who comforted them, who tucked them in. So I really believe that this is how I've always been. I'm a caregiver. You know, I used to fold my little baby brother's diapers when he was born and play with the other two while my mother was feeding the youngest. It has been the way I've always been. And as sad as some of the decisions I've made in my life have been, I've never lost the caregiver component. I'm very proud to be a good mother, and I'm very proud to be a good massage therapist and a dental hygienist. But that's the caregiver in me. That's the part of me that wants to just to help people and take care of them. So I have to say that it's always been there. This is just kind of a manifestation of the person that I must have been from the moment I was born.
Right. And I can definitely see where you came in this world a lot more evolved than most people, because I'm just blown away by not only your books, but just how you interact on a daily basis with people. It's just so refreshing to see somebody with your level of humanity in a world that's so toxic. It's just, you know, you talk about that wind. Well, you're a breath of fresh air just interacting with you. So,
you know,
I consider you a blessing.
Oh, no, thank you. Sometimes my kids will say, Mom, you're so silly, because I get so much joy and enthusiasm from little things that happen, and I just can't help but be ecstatic about what they look at as very silly things. But I can see in their face that they think it's really cool that I'm excitable.
Right.
You know, I just decided a long time ago that if I see something I like, I'm going to say it. If something makes me happy, I'm going to mention it. If I make an observation, I'm going to bring it up, even if everybody else in the room thinks that I've lost my mind.
Well, you're just on such a different level in your ability to perceive the nuances of life that I just find watching you just mind-blowing, because you do get it to such a deep level. It's almost like a walking meditation watching you sometimes. And it's just, I'm just blown away by who you are.
I'm honored, and I just feel like I'm being the person that I was always supposed to be.
I know, and that's what's so cool, is that it's not anything that you're putting on whatsoever. It's just the energy within you is a powerful thing. And the way it dances with the world is just so sweet. David, do you have anything, or...?
Nope, just listening to you ladies and, you know, exchange your thoughts and enjoying every minute of it.
Oh, I know. Now, so you said as far as work environment, though, that you can still do it within the world, but just not to use the love about, because you might end up in human resources.
That's right. I wrote a chapter on at-work love abouts, and basically... You know, you can apply the concept to work, and I made some comment about you can't walk up to somebody and say what you love about them. You might find yourself in the HR office frantically explaining you're trying to try something to enrich your life and deepen your relationships.
Yeah.
You can still compliment people. You can still thank people. And you just leave the word love about out, because a love about is a love about, even if you don't use that phrase.
Right.
And then the other thing you leave out is what you love about yourself, because that could be construed as you're pompous or you're egocentric. But all love abouters know that that's not the case.
Right.
You just save that for later in the day when you are sharing your love abouts with your family. Out in public, love abouts, the same thing. Compliment people. You know, just thank people. And there's so much around you that is worthy of acknowledgement. It's basically about incorporating gratitude into your life. It's really a very simple concept, so I think it's easily overlooked.
Yeah, it definitely is overlooked. And I like the way that you have the rules to keep the compliment pure and not like a mixed with a slap, which so
That's
many
right.
things that people say in this world, you come away feeling like, was that a compliment, or did
Well, you know,
you
there's
know,
the Greek, the three kinds. There's the pure compliment, the mixed compliment, and the tainted compliment. And the tainted compliments are the ones that never feel good. And I think I call them a transparent covering, and they're obvious to everybody else who, you know, hears them. You know, a compliment should never be used to do the opposite of what it was initially intended to do.
Right. And that's hard sometimes, just to learn how to compliment, too. It's a skill set that this book will teach, to learn the boundaries of it and the ones to avoid. So I'm very happy that for you to come on the show and be blessed to hear you read. That's something I'll keep in my mind for so many years to come, just to be able to hear those wonderful words tonight. Can you give us your website and everything so we make sure we have that out there?
Sure. It's www.mbegeling.com. And I'm on Facebook at MB Egling, spelled the same way. And I always encourage people, too, to, if you want to friend my personal page, it's Mary Beth Egling, spelled right out. And I did want to mention, too, before we close, Nell, about my sponsorship for the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children.
Please do.
2 years ago, I approached the National Center for a sanctioned sponsorship. What I wanted to do was give the center 40% of my royalties from Loveabouts for every book I sell. And it was honored last year, and they just renewed my contract. So for another year, until October 1, 2012, every single book I sell of Loveabouts in any form, whether digital, an audio download, or a hard copy, is going to be a gift to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They will get 40% of my royalties for every book I sell.
And the book itself is not a big book. It's something like, and while everybody's starting their Christmas shopping and everything, if you have that coworker and you need that gift to kind of wrap up everything, or even your family members, it would be a great way to start your Christmas tradition by having the whole family even try it at Christmas time. There's so many different ways where this could come to life.
Well, a lot of people have put it in their stockings.
Yeah, it's great for that.
Buying it for new babies. And one lady told me, this is a great bathroom book. And I said, oh, I don't know if I really want to know that it's a great bathroom book. But she goes, no, I leave it in the bathroom, and people read it. So I guess if it's being read, it doesn't really matter where it's being read.
Really,
but it is a very quick read, and it's under $10. It's $8.99. It's inexpensive. And the Kindle and Nook versions, obviously, are a lot less than that. And I did want to mention, too, that I don't know if you knew this, Nell, but every book comes with an audio download. There's actually a code in the back of the book that you can download onto an MP3 player. Yeah, I think it's like the last or second to the last page. So that's a complimentary download that comes with the purchase of the book. So if you have a book, you can load it onto something as well.
Really?
Yes, it's
wow.
I think it's the second to the last page. Yes, it is, the last page
of
the book.
I will definitely check that out. Although I think you're busy supplying the world with them one by one.
Well, let's hope that I can spread the love around and maybe write a big check for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at the end of next year.
Absolutely. David, is there anything you want to say before we close this wonderful night?
No, I just want to thank Mary Beth for a beautiful presentation tonight. And again, congratulations for the sponsorship you've received for the next year. And I also want to thank all our listeners for joining us on this edition of Fire Talk Stage Left. And I want to thank you, Nell Cole, for doing a phenomenal job as always.
Thank you, Dan.
And to our listeners, I just want to say, I hope that you've learned powerful and wonderful lessons from the readings tonight. And I hope and pray to the great mystery that you all walk in beauty, walk in peace, and you be good to one another, because that's what it's all about.
Yes,
sir.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Nell.
Now, before we go, the last song, A Wonderful World, can you tell me why you wanted us to play that song in closing?
because it is a wonderful world. And I wanted to end the program with your permission. You let me pick the songs with one of the most encouraging, positive, uplifting songs that I think has ever been written. And what a nice way to close a program like this and the opportunity that I've been given tonight. And I really appreciate it. Thank both of you.
Thank you. And everybody, take back your family and bring them back to life with Love About. I'm going to play the song now. Good night, everyone.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how do you do. They're really saying I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They're like much more than I never knew. Myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think.